Web streaming of 90.3 WPLN-FM is made possible by listener support and by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, the promise of discovery. Learn how you can support this service at NashvillePublicRadio.org.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle.
And I'm Peter Sagal. This week on our show, it's a veritable Wait, Wait-a-palooza with favorite guests Barry Sonnenfeld, Jim Bouton, and Tenacious D. All that plus Carl Castle returns to his job as a newscaster for one final important story.
There's one danger that looms above all others. I refer, of course, to the robot apocalypse.
It's the Carlminator. We'll be right back after this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. In Afghanistan, U.S. forces have suspended training of local Afghan police and special operation recruits for at least a month. NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson reports the measure is aimed at preventing further shootings of Western troops by Afghans in uniform.
The training by American Special Operations Forces was suspended while officials vet the existing Afghan force to root out Taliban infiltrators or others who pose a threat to international troops. At least 15 U.S. and other international service members were killed in Afghanistan last month in so-called insider shootings. A U.S. forces spokesman, Colonel Thomas Collins, says the suspension affects about 1,000 Afghan recruits belonging to local police or commando units. He and other military officials say that most of the 350,000 Afghan soldiers and national policemen here are still working with NATO-led forces, although the coalition troops now carry loaded weapons at all times to protect themselves. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.
Charlotte, North Carolina is getting ready for the Democratic National Convention, which begins Tuesday. Security is tight. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
The city's downtown feels like it's under partial military control. Orange street closure cones and police vehicles dot the street corners. Charlotte received $50 million in federal grants to enhance security. The size of the police force roughly doubled, with reinforcements from other parts of the country. A diverse group of protesters have set up camp about a half mile from the arena where the first two nights of events will take place. Some anti-Wall Street protests hope to call attention to Charlotte's major presence in banking. Wells Fargo has a major office here, and Bank of America's corporate headquarters reside in the state's tallest skyscraper. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
So what do the Democrats hope to accomplish this week? Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley is head of the Democratic Governors Association. He says they intend to show they are very different from the Republicans.
We are the party that is for Social Security and for Medicare. They are the party that whose choices would lead to insecurity for seniors, and their policy is, I don't care. Go get a voucher. You figure it out.
Aides to Republican Mitt Romney say that he'll spend much of this week preparing for the presidential debates. Hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses along the Gulf Coast are still without power after Hurricane Isaac hit last week. Thousands of people saw their homes flooded. Angela Serpis lives in Braithwaite, Louisiana. She says the entire community is pitching in to help.
People that I don't know have offered me a place to stay, and I don't even know these people. But I just want to say, God is good, and I thank God that I have my safety and my family.
The remnants of the storm moved into the Midwest yesterday, bringing rain to areas that have been suffering from the worst drought in 50 years. This is NPR News. Federal investigators are trying to determine why a plane crashed during an air show in Davenport, Iowa yesterday. Officials say the Soviet-era military jet was flying in formation with other jets when it failed to pull out of a 45-degree bank and crashed into a field. The pilot was killed. No one on the ground was hurt. Authorities in Pakistan have arrested the imam who was involved in a blasphemy case against a young Christian girl accused of burning a Quran. The BBC's Ali McBull reports from Islamabad.
Rimsha Masi has now been in prison for more than 2 weeks, accused of blasphemy. One of her Muslim neighbors accused her of burning pages of the Quran. but there have been new claims that the local Muslim cleric Khalid Chishti planted burnt pages of the Quran in order to frame her. It's clear there had been some tensions between Muslims and Christians in the area, as there have been in many parts of Pakistan, where minorities are often discriminated against. Christians in particular are frequently arrested on the grounds of blasphemy. What's made this case so high profile is that the accused is a child and one with learning difficulties.
The BBC's Aleem Makbul. Desmond Tutu says former British leader Tony Blair and former President George W. Bush should be tried for war crimes. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate wrote an op-ed piece for the Observer newspaper that the two men should face charges in the International Criminal Court for the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. He said the Iraq war has destabilized and polarized the world to a greater extent than any other conflict in history. Tutu says the two men fabricated the grounds for invasion to behave like playground bullies. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Sterling Clark Foundation to sustain NPR's coverage of Latin American cultural programming on Alt Latino.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Great to see you. So listen, we did what a lot of people did. We kind of wasted the summer. We hung out. We sat down to answer email. The next thing we know, it's 40 YouTube videos later, and it's dark outside. So we're taking this week off to cram in as much summer as we can in the little time that's left.
I'm going surfing with a jet ski, hiking boots, and a keg.
Well, we try to survive that. We've got some of our favorite bits lined up for you. In April, we did our show in Boston, home of the Red Sox, so naturally, we invited a former pitcher from the Yankees to join us on stage.
Jim Boughton joined us on stage along with panelists Alonzo Bowden, Jesse Klein, and Mo Rocca. And Peter began by asking him about the reception to his tell-all baseball memoir, Ball 4, when it came out in 1970.
Well, there was a great deal of objection from two quarters. One was the sports writers.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the access I had, and they had been sort of pushing, a milk and cookies, Boy Scout kind of view of players.
Right.
Also, the owners were against the book because Ball 4 was the first book to tell people how difficult it was to make a living in baseball.
Yeah, it was hard.
Minimum salary was $7,000. My average salary for 8 years in the major leagues was $19,000.
But did the other players get mad at you for telling tales out of the locker room, I guess?
Well, some of the guys did, but you got to understand, in those days, most guys who played professional baseball had, a little more than a high school education. These were not readers.
Right.
You know, unlike today. if you were on a bus, a team bus, going to some, airport or something like that, and you were reading a book, they called you the professor. these guys were innocents, and they were very vulnerable, and that's why they were they were able to take advantage of these guys.
Sure. So we're here in Boston this week. What is it like, since you've done it, to play at Fenway Park?
It's like pitching at the Roman Colosseum. At any moment, Fenway Park is a great place to play ball. I'm telling you, it's the only stadium where you can be on the mound and hear personal insults from the stands.
Really,
that
right?
Close. It's interactive.
It's great, and it starts way before the game. When the team bus pulls up to Fenway Park at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for a 7 o'clock game, there are 250 people hollering at you in a foreign language.
Right.
And that starts it off.
Really? So you're welcome and made to feel warm as soon as you show up.
Oh, yeah.
You realize that now that you've said that you can hear them, it's going to be worse.
Yeah. Now they
Everyone's
know.
Everyone's like, oh, they can hear.
I loved pitching in Fenway Park. I thought it was a great experience.
You enjoyed it? Did you enjoy infuriating the crowd?
Well, my best one was, I don't know if you remember, when Dick Raddatz, the monster, 6'8" guy, big guy, great relief pitcher. And he would come into the ninth inning and he would strike out the side, Mantle, Maris, and Tresh. And he would walk off the mound with his arms raised over his head. And he was the monster. And the crowd would roar. Well, on a Sunday, I pitched a shutout. And I decided that it would be a good idea to walk off the mound with my arms over my head.
Right.
I walked off like I was the monster, and all this food and beverage started coming. Hot dogs, beer cans. I was dodging food on my way to the dugout. And
as you get to the dugout, you get closer to the people throwing the food.
Yeah, right, right.
You have less time to react.
But there was shelter there, too, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Underneath something. Frankie Crosetti said, "Are you crazy? Don't you know these people?
Don't you know where you are? They'll
right.
kill you." That's terrible.
Yeah.
One of the things in your book is you suggest that the coaches and managers have no idea what they're talking about. And have no effect. Is that true?
At that time it was.
Right.
You know, today I don't know what impact the manager has or what impact the coaches have, because I'm really not close enough to the game. But back then, the manager was usually, some former player who everybody liked. And then he chose a coaching staff made up of basically his drinking buddies. I mean, so that was very unscientific.
Right.
Very unscientific back then. That was way before, sabermetrics and all that stuff.
Right, and you have guys coming in and telling you to do one thing one day, and the next day they'd come in and they'd say, "Do something else." And you'd be like, "I have no, what?"
Yeah, well, they would say like, "Hey, what are you doing with that baseball? I was going to take it out inside and throw it." "No, put it back in the bag. The baseballs don't come out until later." You know, that kind of stuff.
Well, that's an important bit of guidance for you.
Yes,
to tell you not to take the baseball out until later. That's the kind of guidance you got? Like, put the damn baseball down.
Right.
He's going to help you with your pitching. Put the baseball down.
What are you doing with those baseballs? I'm bringing them outside. Just take one. Okay. I wish I could say I was kidding.
If you were talking to a non-baseball fan, and believe it or not, there are some, how would you pitch the game? What excites you about the game?
What doesn't excite me about the game is the stepping out of the batter's box. What are you stepping out of the batter's box for?
You mean when the people step out of the batter and delay the game?
After every pitch, guy steps out of the batter's box, he's got to fix the straps on his glove.
He's got to spit in his hand, depending.
All that. If they eliminated Velcro, it would knock 20 minutes off of every game. And I don't like guys hitting home runs and then raising their arms up like they just discovered a cure for cancer. "Hey, look at me, I just hit a home run." In our day, you hit a home run, you put your head down, you ran around the bases, you went into the dugout, and you shut up. You know why?
Why?
Because it's just a home run.
Right.
It's not a religious experience.
You weren't much of a hitter, though. Did you ever hit one?
I never hit a home run.
Well, then how do you know?
All right, so maybe I would have raised my hand.
I'm going to say it. All right, Jim Boughton, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling
A Fistful of Greenies. That's nothing.
So you famously wrote about shenanigans in baseball, which have arguably gotten worse since then. But compared to other sports around the world, baseball players are hardly immoral at all. We're going to ask you three questions about people who really know how to cheat. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in their home answering machine. Carl, who is Jim Boughton playing for?
Jim is playing for Margaret Brown of Hamilton, Massachusetts.
Ready to go?
I'm ready.
Here is your first question. First question. One of these was the biggest scandal of the Sydney Olympic Games of 2000. Was it A, the Spanish Paralympics basketball team, none of whose members were actually disabled? B, the Estonian sailing team, which used an outboard motor? Or C, a Finnish fencer who hit a taser in his glove?
Ooh, I like the Finnish fencer idea. Yeah, I like.
You're going to go with that?
I'm going with that.
You're going to go with that? Sadly, it was the Spanish Paralympics basketball team. The scam was revealed by a journalist who actually got onto the team. And after the Olympics and they won their gold medal, he revealed that nobody in the team was actually disabled. They were all faking. And once the report was published, they had to give up their gold medal.
Oh. So I never read the sports section.
I understand. There's nothing there of any interest for any person. All right, you still have two more chances here. Jockey Sly Cormoosh, that's his real name, Sly Cormoosh, once used a heavy fog bank to win a horse race. How? A, he just stopped his horse, waited for the rest of the horses to come around the track, and then raced ahead of them to cross the finish line first. B, he got off his slow horse, rode around on a faster one, then jumped back on the slow one to win. Or C, he moved a fence that all the other horses got lost.
Whoa. I like the horse stopping.
He stopped and waited for him to come around. That's what he did.
Yeah, okay.
Huge fog bank. Nobody could see him. So as soon as he got out of the gate, he just reined up, waited for them to come around, and then he just rode in ahead of them to win. Although he got greedy, he won by too much, so people started asking questions. Last question. This is good. If you get this one right, you'll win.
Like 2 out of 3?
You get 2 out of 3, you win.
All right.
Perhaps the most famous sporting scandal ever was the strange attack on Nancy Kerrigan right before the 1994 Winter Olympics.
Oh, yes, yes.
Remember this? Arranged by her rival, Tonya Harding.
Right.
Ms. Harding was banned from figure skating after that was all done, but her athletic career did not end. She went on to do what? A, have a stint as the third seat in a professional bobsledding team. B, fight Bill Clinton accuser Paula Jones in a celebrity boxing match. Or C, she founded a very short-lived new sport called crowbar fencing.
I know the answer to this.
I think it was the bobsledding thing.
You think it was bobsledding?
No. It wasn't the crowbar one, so it had to be the other one.
Well, you have to decide.
Oh my God! I remember it was the boxing.
It was. You were right. They were right. Mel was right. She had a celebrity boxing match with Paula Jones, and as the boxing writers like to say, she stopped Ms. Jones in 3. So there you are. Carl, how did Jim Bouton do in our show?
Jim did well enough. 2 correct answers, Jim, so you win for Margaret Brown. Congratulations.
There you are. If you want to throw your hands up in victory, we really won't mind here.
This is a public radio home run.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Jim Bouton's classic baseball memoir, Ball 4, is now available as an ebook and an audiobook. Jim Bouton, thank you so much for being on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell.
Thank you.
Jim Bouton, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. When we come back, movie director Barry Sonnenfeld and a segment that you have to assemble yourself with an Allen wrench. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Esurance, an Allstate company, offering tools to help guide customers through the car insurance process from quote to claim. Learn more at Esurance.com. The John D. and Catherine D. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. And Angie's List, providing reviews on local AC repair, landscapers, doctors, and others based on member experiences at Angie'sList.com. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR. We'll be right back.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you so much. We are trying to stuff a summer's worth of fun into one last desperate week. We're having 5 cookouts a day.
One advantage, standing close enough to the grill helps your tan.
We've combed our archives for our favorite segments, and we noticed some prominent themes in our coverage. For example, the Swedish furniture chain IKEA.
We mention them so often, we've gotten our own IKEA names. I'm Carl Moe, with 2 little dots over the A.
Here's some important stories from our IKEA desk, which, naturally, we had to assemble ourselves. Moe, yes. IKEA is famous for making adorable cheap furniture and Swedish meatballs. Now they've announced plans to make a whole what?
Well, they also make lingonberries. They don't make them. They provide them. They're going to make... cars wouldn't be interesting. I don't think it's really adorable, the furniture.
Sort of an extreme extension of what they do already.
An extension of what they make already.
Maybe it'll be called Lingonberry Bird.
Oh, they're going to make an IKEA town.
Yes, they are.
An entire town.
They're going to build it. This new 27-acre community outside London will come with 40,000 pages of wordless assembly instructions. And an Allen wrench the size of a telephone pole. It is yet to be named, but you can bet that the name will have an umlaut somewhere. The biggest danger, of course, is they finish building the whole town, the streets, the homes, and they have all these parts left over.
Is the whole town going to smell like meatballs?
It will.
That you don't really want?
Real estate analysts predict that in 2 years you'll be able to buy the whole town on Craigslist when everybody moves up to Crate and Barrelsville.
Where do you find contractors and construction workers to build an IKEA town? It just seems...
Oh, it's, you do it yourself.
Oh,
the entire town packs flat. You can put it on top of your station wagon. Open it up.
And here's another question from the IKEA files.
Roxanne, IKEA knows that shopping for furniture can be stressful for couples, and they're trying to help. What are they now offering at some of their stores?
Well, they already have a place where you can park the children.
Yes, that's great. But what they really need, and some now offer, is a place where you can park who?
Your mother-in-law.
No.
where you can park husbands?
Yeah, and basically a place to park your husbands, boyfriends. It's a play area for men. IKEA, as you know, if you go there, has a child play area called Small Land. And now women at certain IKEA stores can ditch their annoying husbands or boyfriends as well in Manland. You assume there's a little circle over the A, Manland. There's foosball, comfy chairs, video games, free hot dogs, everything a man could want, short of not being forced to go shopping in the first place. And this is great. They give the women who drop off the husbands and boyfriends a buzzer to remind them to collect their men. Before they leave the store. So now IKEA has to deal with both a pile of abandoned buzzers and a pile of abandoned husbands.
Let's take one more trip down the bewildering aisles of IKEA. For this one, we were joined by Mo Rocca, Adam Felber, and Roxanne Roberts.
Mo.
Yes.
A controversial decision by Swedish furniture maker IKEA has the company facing an international backlash. Customers around the world are horrified at IKEA's decision to change what?
Oh, gosh. It can't be their logo. That's too
It's
boring.
Close, actually, to their logo.
Is it not their color scheme?
No.
Does it have anything to do with their directions? Their
It has to do with their printed catalogs.
Oh, okay. That their catalogs are now... you're going to have to put the catalogs together without any instructions?
But no, people were crying all over the world. What the Helvetica, they were saying.
Oh, they've changed their font.
They did. We all know the IKEA font, right?
Yes, I love the IKEA font.
But the ads from the Swedish furniture maker IKEA caused horror, not because they'd raised the price in the Bjorkful candle holders, but because they changed their font. No more were the stylish Bibi Snur duvet covers advertised in the Futura font we all know and love, but instead they used that cheap, trashy, a revised font, Verdana.
Verdana?
Verdana!
That trollop.
Twitter instantly erupted with complaints. IKEA, stop the Verdana madness, came a plea from Tokyo. Words can't describe my disgust, said a disgusted Australian, using words.
To describe his disgust?
IKEA said, this is true. They switched to Verdana because they said it's more cost-effective.
Wait, what was the one they were using before?
They were using Futura.
Oh, that runs you by the letter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that'll run you, especially with the consonants. They add up.
Did you say Bjorkful at one point?
Yeah, I said Bjorkful.
But she's Icelandic.
I'm just telling you the name of the candle holders are Bjorkful. You are so Bjorkful to me.
Can't you see?
I think that should be a Marvel character.
Bjorkful. This is I, Bjorkful. The power to disassemble myself and reassemble myself anywhere with a small minimum of cursing. I have the power to furnish divorced men's apartments. When you think of successful movie directors, you think of people like the guy in Fellini's movie 8 1/2, confident, half dictator, half philosopher, half womanizer.
That's three halves.
Don't quibble. So we were surprised and delighted to talk to Barry Sonnenfeld, director of such huge Hollywood movies as the Men in Black films and Get Shorty. Turns out he's just as odd and nervous as we are.
Speak for yourself, Peter. Barry joined panelists Paula Poundstone, Tom Baudet, and Amy Dickinson back in April and told us how he got his start.
I grew up in Washington Heights. I was an only child of Jewish persuasion.
Really? Now, in the cultural stereotype with which I am familiar, that would mean that your parents doted on you somewhat. Was that true?
Well, let's just say we recently passed Earth Day, and on April 22nd, 1969, at 2:20 in the morning, during an Earth Day concert, while Jimi Hendrix was warming up, the following announcement came over the speakers at Madison Square Garden. Barry Sonnenfeld, call your mother.
No!
You are kidding me.
No, I'm not.
Oh, whoa.
And did you, in fact, call your mother?
Well, I was supposed to be at home at 2. It was 2:20. So, and by the way, the perseverance of my mother to actually find someone at the garden and convince them this was an emergency was so amazing that by the time I got to the payphone, this is pre-cell phones, I assumed that someone had died. So I called my mother uncontrollably in tears and said, who died? And her response was, I assumed you did. Why aren't you at home?
Wow.
And how many years of therapy have you had, sir?
You know, not enough, as it turns out.
Apparently. Well, we have benefited from that, I guess. So you're a Jewish kid. You grew up in New York with a Jewish mother. Whenever I've seen a photo of you, you're always wearing cowboy boots and a cowboy hat.
Yes. You see, the truth is I embrace all things cowboy. It's my way of trying to be manly. I often wear fake cowboy mustaches.
Really?
You know, when you're on the set and it gets really boring, you say to the hair and makeup people, hey, you got any interesting mustaches today?
Have you ever actually spent time with or around actual cowboys doing cowboy things, riding and roping and stuff like that?
I forgot to mention that I direct while sitting on a saddle.
Wait a minute. What?
I'm on a saddle that sits on what's called an apple box that has wheels. And recently, the grips had to add additional wheels because the saddle kept throwing me.
Oh. Wait a minute. It's like, cut, everybody. The director's chair just threw him to the ground.
Yes.
I had always understood that a movie director needs to be a dictator, needs to exude absolute authority to get everybody to get together and move in the same direction, all these egos, actors and technicians and artists. Does the saddle help with that?
Well,
and the cowboy hat?
One of the things that I learned from my mother, I call strength through weakness.
Okay.
And I find that if you look like you're in need, because, you know, the saddle is throwing you and stuff. Others will really come and sort of take up the slack.
So instead of, like, striking fear into their hearts or demanding their loyalty with your authority, you're sort of relying on their pity. They're like, oh, let's not misbehave. Barry might crack.
Oh, God, yes. And it's worked for me quite well.
Barry, didn't you direct Wild Wild West?
Yes, and that was very difficult because of the actual horses involved in that movie.
I know.
Yes, Wild Wild West, this was the reboot of the famous TV series that had it had Will Smith and Kevin Kline. And it was an actual Western. There you were. Horses. Did you actually get to ride a horse around?
I personally avoided the horses. You don't want to go anywhere near a horse. They're kind of really scary to me.
Wait a minute. So you dress like a cowboy. You sit on a saddle when you're directing your movies, but you are scared of horses.
Yes, but Peter, I'm also afraid of aliens, but I've managed to do these Men in Black movies all.
You have. So wait a minute. You're saying that you approach these topics, these Westerns, these big movies, out of a sense of fear and anxiety?
It's funny you say that because my motto in life is live in fear.
Well, how does that work out?
It's great because you're never disappointed.
I wanted to ask you about Men in Black 3, a big fan of the first two. And it's weird because a lot of guys, particularly in Hollywood, end up making sequels to their films these days, I mean. But this is 15 years after the first one came out. Is it weird to go back to the same characters and the story and the same look so many years after you did it the first time?
You know, it's been great because Will Smith is the same sort of overly energetic guy. I describe him as if he's an eight-month-old Great Dane puppy. You know, on various shows, he's harmed me. On Wild Wild West, he broke my fifth metacarpal in five places.
How did he do that?
I hit his shoulder.
Why did you hit his shoulder?
Peter, you can't believe how boring making movies can be.
All
and
right.
So Will and I got into a habit of trading punches. And he would hit me as hard as he could, and I would collapse in pain in my shoulder. And then I would hit him as hard as I could, and he would laugh uncontrollably. And one day I decided, I want to hurt Will Smith.
Well, who hasn't thought that? But go on.
Well, I punched him so hard, and his shoulder is like hitting, you know, like a brick wall. So I collapsed in pain, had to go to the hospital. Couldn't say why this happened because, you know, we're responsible adults here.
Couldn't you just say that you fell off your fake horsey?
Well, you know, I could have. Instead, I said I walked into a door.
With your fist?
Well, you know, with my fist. It can happen. And when the doctor rolled up my sleeve to take my blood pressure, he saw that my shoulder was covered in red, orange, purple, green, and yellow welts from Will hitting me. And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "I have no idea." So basically, I was a battered wife.
No, I understand. So what I love is that you said this, you introduced this story by saying that Will Smith broke your hand, and it turns out he broke your hand by standing there while you attempted to hit him.
Listen, he also tore my rotator cuff, and I recently had to have surgery because he tackled me and shoved his chin into my shoulder, and when I sent him the post-op photo of me with tubes, you know, coming out of my nose and stuff, he emailed me back saying, and I quote, "That's hilarious."
So I guess we understand why it took 10 years between the Men in Black movies. You had to recover from your injuries.
Exactly.
It sounds like the only solace you have is your fake horse.
You know, the fake horse has been, it's just fantastic. In fact, it's something that you're making fun of, but you would be jealous and wish you had one.
I
am.
As soon as this show is over, I am demanding of my producers that I get a little saddle on some crates, and I want to wear boots and chaps and have a hat.
I will send you photos.
I believe it. Well, Barry Sonnenfeld, what a pleasure to talk to you.
You too.
We've invited you here to play a game we're calling
Men in White.
Your heroes wear black, your Men in Black movies, but cricketers, mm-hmm. that would be those who play cricket,
yep.
they wear white.
Yep.
We don't know why they wear white. We don't know anything about cricket, but the question is, do you, sir, answer three questions correctly about the game that probably has a charming old nickname, and you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in their voicemail. Carl, who is director Barry Sonnenfeld playing for?
Barry is playing for Tim Sheehan of Sandwich, Massachusetts.
Ready to play?
Yep.
All right. Here's your first question. Which of these is a real rule of cricket? A, any player can appeal an umpire's ruling by shouting, "How's that?" B, your team is docked one run if you are seen to step on or otherwise harass an insect on the field. Or C, I don't know what this means, but quote, the wicket crease cannot be popped during an innings.
I like anything involving yelling.
So you're going to go with how's that?
I'm going with how's that.
You're right, how's that? That's the rule.
Oh, jeez.
The rule in cricket is you can appeal the umpire's ruling, and they shout, how's that? Or it's become informal, they go, how? And the umpire says, out. Huh. All right, next, you're doing very well. Which of these, this is the next question, which of these is legal under the rules of cricket? A, insulting the other players during play. B, the pitcher or bowler can spit on the ball all he wants. Or C, if he wants to, the batsman can just pick up the ball and throw it.
Well, I don't think it would be spitting because that seems uncivilized. I'm going to go with picking up the ball and throwing it.
If you get frustrated trying to hit it, you can just pick it up, throw it as far as you can.
I'm going to go that way.
Actually, it's spitting. Believe it or not, spitballs are legal in cricket. You can spit on the ball, and you can polish the ball to try to make it spin. However, one Pakistani bowler in a big cricket match went too far and caused a scandal a while ago when he was caught doing what? Was it A, subbing in a magic eight ball for the cricket ball, B, attaching a string to the ball so he could pull it back, or C, biting the ball like an apple?
Well, I'm going biting.
And you're right, sir. That's right. The rules are you can spit on the ball, but you can't deface it, cut it, or put on a foreign substance. Biting was going too far. He was banned for 2 games. Carl,
now, I have to admit that I once had a landlord who was a famous Jewish cricket player from South Africa.
So you know a little bit about cricket?
Nothing. I just had a landlord who was a Jew.
Wherever he is now, he's very proud of you. Carl, how did Barry Sonnenfeld do in our quiz?
Well, Barry, you had 2 correct answers, so that's enough to win for Tim Sheehan of Sandwich, Massachusetts. Congratulations.
Well done.
Fantastic.
Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. When we come back, leprechauns, monsters, and robots. And if that's not scary enough, how about Jack Black? Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at progressive.com. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And the Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, guys. You know, one of the things we like to do on our show is keep you prepared, not for natural disasters, but for unnatural disasters. It's the stuff you don't expect that will get you in the end.
For example, you definitely want to be on the watch for tiny Irish people who promise you gold.
Paul, the celebration of St. Patrick's Day this week reminds us that many in Ireland are sick and tired of the stereotypes people have about the Irish. In fact, last week a team in Ireland opened a museum to rehab the image of one particular sect of Irish society. Whom?
The Druids.
Close, but no cigar.
The alcoholics. The famous Irish. Famous.
No, he said one particular sect. He didn't say.
Oh, I'm sorry. Listen.
No, I mean, they're like much like druids, they are magical.
This
smaller.
Oh, the leprechauns?
The leprechauns, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Dublin's $6.8 million National Leprechaun Museum wants to re-educate people about leprechauns.
Oh, original... look, there it is.
Exactly.
Down there.
The original leprechaun comes from 8th century Irish folklore, and it's a far cry from the cute little guy where, you know, saying top of the morning on your St. Patrick's Day card.
Or on your cereal box.
Exactly. Turns out the original leprechaun, or the OL, as they like to call themselves... It was a sometimes sinister magical creature. For instance, the 8th century leprechaun's Lucky Charm cereal was also magically delicious, but instead of having pink hearts and yellow moon marshmallows, it was filled with actual hearts and rat poison. And the legend went, if you managed to catch him at the end of a rainbow, he would give you syphilis. Here's a question about an unnatural danger that was so great that President Bush warned us about it in a State of the Union speech. Charlie, concerned about the threats that our nation faces at this difficult time, a group of Republicans in the Senate have introduced a bill to ban what?
This is my favorite senator, Senator Sam Brownback, who introduced a bill with a number of co-sponsors to ban human-animal hybrids.
In fact, yes.
This is called locking the barn after the centaur has been stolen.
Yes. I was about to say... It's not been a good week for the Republicans in terms of the Latino vote. They're also kissing the mermaid vote goodbye this week.
However, Democratic Congressman Dr. Moreau was in opposition.
Human-animal hybrids will be banned overseas. You see, scientists are fusing human DNA with that of cows and other animals to forward medical research, and because it's totally awesome. Imagine if they could combine you with a pig. You'd have bacon 24/7. Sam Brownback of Kansas, as you said, he introduced the legislation. He says creating human-animal hybrids is a violation of human dignity and challenges the definition of what it means to be human. So under the proposed law, mermaids, mermen, centaurs would be banned, or at least they'd have to use separate entrances at restaurants. On the other side, Democrats said this is ridiculous, it solves a problem that doesn't exist, and everybody should just calm down. And then Henry Waxman quietly gave himself a cat bath.
There's one danger that looms above all others. I refer, of course, to the robot apocalypse.
Mo, there's a new U.S. military robot being developed. It's called the Energetically Autonomous Tactical Robot, or EATER, E-A-T-R, EATER. It's capable of seeking out biomass energy from the environment to power itself. This week, the maker of the robot had to formally deny widespread reports that the robot would use what as fuel?
Human flesh.
Exactly right. The EATER robot is designed to go on long-range, long-term military missions. It's eco-friendly. It's independent. That's all super. Unless it feasts on the flesh of man, as Fox News and a number of blogs suggested it would. In response to such concerns, the CEO of the company, which makes the robot, said, and I quote him, "We completely understand the public's concern about futuristic robots feeding on the human population, but that is not our mission." End quote.
What?
Boy, I feel better.
Yeah.
What if it's...
At this time, he did not add.
What if it's only feeding on cellulite?
Well, that would be maybe good.
Oh. It would be like kind of liposuction.
Yeah, take care of your cankles for you. That would be fun.
Right. Well, because liposuction isn't very sexy, but to have a robot suck it off of you...
Now, it's kind of like a personal Roomba.
Fox News... which uncharacteristically got quite hysterical about this. The EATR engine might be used in vehicles, including ambulances, seems like the worst possible application of an engine fueled by people. You're hurt. The EMTs roll you into the back. They close the doors. They rush you to the ER. They get there. They open up. All that comes out is a burp. And when the robots finally come to kill us, we'll remember ruefully that we started them off small. Roxanne, and what is being hailed as a major breakthrough in robot technology, a team from the University of California, Berkeley, has taught a robot how to do what?
To kiss.
No.
I would consider it's that nice, an innovation in robotry.
Nice sci-fi twist there.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah.
What is kiss?
No, not kiss. Something presumably more useful than that.
Okay, I'm going to need a hint then.
They'll be stationed outside of dryers.
They'll be stationed out. Fold the laundry.
Close enough. Pair socks.
Wow.
Finally. An innovation that will make a difference in our lives.
You know that would make a difference in my life.
Yeah.
I waste entirely too much time pairing socks.
Wait. Can I just make a small point?
You may.
All right. I sent my 18-year-old to college, and I bought him 24 pairs of exactly the same socks.
That's right. Good thinking.
Because... If you buy all the same socks, this is not an issue.
Yeah. Well, you know what the problem
right
is.
Right now, some scientists are listening to the show in Berkeley and crying, Roxanne. you just solved something that they just spent $50 million of stimulus money on.
Well, you know what the problem is. You know what it's like. You get the laundry out of the dryer, and you confront the huge pile of unmatched, almost but not quite identical socks, and you say to yourself, just sell the house and walk away. It'll be easier. But technology to the rescue. A team of programmers taught the robot to identify, pair, and fold together a single pair of socks in just 15 minutes.
I'm just going to ask the guys, how many different color socks do you have?
On me at this moment? Two.
We've interviewed a lot of musicians on the show, but recently we got a chance to interview the greatest rock band ever in all of history. That would be Tenacious D, also known as actor Jack Black, and his friend Kyle Gass.
We were joined by Brian Babylon, Charlie Pierce, and Roxanne Roberts, and we began with Jack Black trying to describe what their music is all about.
Well, it's been said that we're a combination of Black Sabbath and... Who's the other band, Cage? We're horrible at describing ourselves.
Apparently. I would say like Black Sabbath and Simon and Garfunkel.
Thank
you. If you could imagine that.
Yeah, we revel in the 1970s and 80s rock when Satan was real.
Exactly. He has since retired.
He's sold out.
Yeah. Could you guys, because you know, we hear sometimes from heavy metal bands who are like, oh no, we're not really Satanists. You know, but you guys really are. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did... I'm interested. You guys met back in the 80s when you were both in the Actors Gang, right? Tim Robbins' group out in L.A.
It's true.
And you started playing music together as part of that?
Well, Kyle was sort of the official de facto musician of the theater company at the time. And I tried to hold on to Kyle's coattails, but he kept on kicking me off. I was like a little dog humping his leg.
Yeah.
And then finally he let me in. I melted his icy shield. And we spent years just in his apartment jamming stonily along, searching for our sound. And finally we worked up the courage to go play a little dive bar in downtown Los Angeles. And we only had one song, and it was the greatest song in the world, Tribute.
Tribute is a great song.
Yeah, and thus was born.
And thus was born Tenacious.
So, hey, Jack, how, you know, sometimes when you sing songs and you're able to, like, not say words, but, like, say noises, like, zip-a-doo-doo, ba-da-ba-da-boo-doo-doo.
Oh.
How do you do that, man? That's amazing.
The scat?
The scats, man. Those scats.
Where does scat come from?
That's a lot of power to scats.
Well, you know, I'm heavily influenced by Bobby McFerrin.
Oh, sure. You can hear that.
I would watch in the back of the audience and in wonder, because he satisfied a certain thing in me. I wanted to be a one-man show. I wasn't able to do it. That's why me and Kyle had to join forces. But if I could, I would be reincarnated as
Bobby McFerrin Jr.
Lyrics are kind of overrated anyway, aren't they?
For most, yeah. If you listen to the greatest rock band of all time, Led Zeppelin,
yes,
the lyrics are mostly gobbledygook.
But, you mean there's no bustle in my hedgerow?
Yeah.
I got alarmed for nothing.
Does anyone remember laughter?
Yeah, go on.
We place a high premium on our lyrics because the comedy is the source of our power. So
they are very, very funny.
Yeah,
they are hilariously funny and extraordinarily profane. In fact, we noticed that there's an explicit version of the new record and a clean version. We're guessing the clean version is 2 minutes long.
No.
No, really?
We took great pains to replace all the cuss words with creative, funny alternatives that were clean enough for the kids.
Can you give me an example
and
of
the religious people?
Yeah. Can you give me an example of like your favorite fake cuss word you had to put in to keep the rhythm right?
Wow, you know, it's hard to remember. I never listened to the clean one.
Let me try it. Well, we have this one called Death Star, and it goes, the world is freaking turning to poop. Okay, that was not a good example of creativity.
I know. Got the point across, though.
There's some better ones in there, I'm sure.
I know.
There's got to be.
One thing that people might know, if they've been paying attention, Jack, is that you've been doing some movies to some success.
True.
And there's a song on the new record called The Ballad of Hollywood Jack and the Rage Cage.
Yes.
And that describes these two very good friends who are musicians, one named Jack and one named Cage. And
yeah.
Jack gets really famous doing movies, and the other guy gets really upset about it.
Yeah.
Jealous.
For those that don't know, Kyle is the Rage Cage.
Really? Because I was going to ask, first, if that was autobiographical, and second, which one you were. So I guess my question is that based in truth?
Every word of it is true.
Really?
Every word, yeah. It was a very difficult song to write because of its painful truths. And we weren't going to do it. I mean, we had this title, Hollywood Jack and the Rage Cage, brewing for years. And
wow.
It doesn't sound funny, does it?
No. No, it's very sad, actually.
It was the elephant in the room, and it needed to be written.
Right. So you wrote the elephant. And how are you guys getting along now?
Oh, as long as there's a record deal, we'll always be friends.
Yeah, I understand.
I think I consider Kyle to be my best friend.
And I as well.
Oh. Oh. Well, Tenacious D, Jack and Kyle, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Tenacious D, meet Tenacious P.
So we tried to think of the singer who would be the diametrical opposite of Tenacious D, and who better to fill that role than Mr. Pat Boone? We'll ask you about the cleanest cut guy who ever cut a record. Get 2 out of 3 right. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in the home answering machine. Carl, who is Tenacious D playing for?
Tenacious D is playing for Dick Fortin of Eaton Center, New Hampshire.
All right, ready to go, guys?
Yes.
And you are allowed.
You're up on your Pat Boone trivia, aren't you?
Oh gosh, yes.
Okay, good.
All right. You are allowed to collaborate, bicker, break up, whatever you need to do to get through this. Here we go.
Okay.
Now, Pat was the master of all media, it seemed, during his heyday in the 50s and the 60s. He even appeared where? Was it A, on a metal record sent into space to greet aliens? B, as a character in the comic book Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane? Or C, he has a cameo as a traveling minstrel in Fellini's cinematic masterpiece, La Strada?
It's A.
It's A, he's on the record sent into space?
Yes.
Do you both agree on this question?
I'm going with Kyle because he's known as the Filofax. Was that on Voyager? I think I saw that on Star Trek.
So your choice is A, the record. I'm afraid it was actually B, the comic book. The record wasn't sent until much later.
Oh,
yeah. See, in the comic book, which came out in the late 50s, Superman must prevent Pat Boone from singing a song about him, which would reveal his secret identity. He does this.
Man.
He does this by tearing Pat Boone in half with his hands.
Oh, hold on.
Actually, no, I'm kidding. He doesn't really. But you still have 2 more chances, guys, so here's your next question.
Okay.
Mr. Boone's media career was boosted by his clean-cut image But sometimes his morals got in the way, as when what happened? A, on the set of his first film, he refused to kiss co-star Shirley Jones because she was married to somebody else. B, he refused to have Elvis Presley on his Pat Boone TV show because, quote, that man's hips makes me think of impure things. Or C, he gave up a lucrative endorsement contract with Canada Dry once he learned that people mix their sodas with alcohol.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, that's a stumper. I'm 0 for 1, Jack. I don't know. You may have to take this one.
I hope that it's number 2, because that's just really the funniest of the possibilities. I think it's number 1, though.
You think it's number 1? He refused to kiss Shirley Jones? And that is, in fact, what it was. Very good. Apparently, Mr. Boone was only willing to pretend to be romantically involved with single actresses.
Yeah.
All right, this is good. You're 1 for 1, 1 for 2 with 1 to go. If you get this, you'll win. Here we go. Mr. Boone had an important role in legal history. Was it A, he pioneered the right for a celebrity to control his image when he sued the makers of an adult film called Pat Boom? B, he was the first celebrity endorser sued by the FTC for making false claims about a product? Or C, accused by a fan of untoward advances, he got off with what is now known as the "Who are you kidding? I'm Pat Boone" defense.
It's clearly the second one.
He was the first celebrity endorser successfully sued by the Federal Trade Commission for making false claims about product.
Yeah, I like it.
We'll
I like
with number 2.
Yeah, let's hold it.
And you're right, guys. That's what it was. He endorsed. He, in the 70s, endorsed an acne cream called Acne Statin. The FTC went after him. They said, no, it doesn't work. And he apologized and said he would not endorse it anymore. Carl, how did Jack and Kyle do in our show?
Jack and Kyle had 2 correct answers, Peter, and that's enough to win for Dick Fortin. Congratulations, guys.
Tenacious D's new album is Rise of the Phoenix. It's out now. Jack and Kyle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
you. You guys are great.
Care.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. The Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues at parkfoundation.org, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, Benevolent Overlord. Philip Gotica writes our limericks, our house manager is Don Hall, our intern is Mackenzie Van Engelenhoven, our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Lester Larchick and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank, BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Eva Waltrover and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Lorna White. Our production coordinator is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer, Ian Chillog. The executive producer, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is Michael Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle. Thanks to all of our panelists. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal, and we'll see you again next week. This is NPR.
celebrating 50 years of community service and community support, this is 90.3 WPLN Nashville Public Radio, 91.5 WTML Tullahoma, and 91.7 WHRS Cookeville. You can find a complete schedule of all our programs and listen to a live stream of any of our program channels at WPLN.org. It's 12 o'clock.